Sorry to play music from another generation, but it's the only one I still remember, and it still contains traces of real truth. So thank you, Donovan, for lighting up the 60s with that that music. The reason that I play it again tonight is that it signifies a structure that is inherent to the consciousness and the process, if you wish to call it that, or the map, if you will, of the logic of liberation. So it's useful to understand this, let's call it the Zen dialectic, as an intellectual pathway from the false self to the real. So, using the formula of the song, so we have a dialectic, a thesis, the negation of that thesis, and then the negation of the negation. So first there is an ego, and you believe you are that ego, and that ego is made up of a thought representation of the real self. Ramana calls that the I thought, but it's only a concept in the mind. And the ego is a concept that contains both a subject and a predicate. So it's the predicate that creates the difficulties. And it's only when you negate, first off, both the subject and the predicate of the egoic assertion that basically, I am Joe or John or Devadatta or Xi Jinping or whatever, but I am a particular entity in the world, right? I am not some formless blob of mental disturbance, let's say, or just mental passivity. No, I am a person in the world, and I have a purpose, and I have a will, and I have desires, and I have all kinds of things, because the ego projects a world that will try to satisfy its sense of lack of real being, because it is only a representation of the self. So the problem is that the ego is desperate to affirm its reality. That's what the ego wants to do, to affirm itself, to prove I am somebody and I'll do something special and I'll make the world better and they'll remember me and there'll be a statue of me in the central square and right, et cetera, et cetera. Or whatever is the version of it. I'll make a hit record, or I will, write the great Costa Rican novel, or, I will do something that will bring a sense of fulfillment to life. Maybe I'll just make my mother happy, but I'll do something that will prove that I'm worthy and that I'm on the side of the rightness and the goodness, and I can accept myself and I can let go of all this self-loathing and victimization and anger and all of that one day once I'm recognized and adored, right? So there's the ego's plan of attack on its own dream field. In order to reach the real self, you cannot affirm that ego. You have to negate it. And that's the one thing that the ego will not allow. But if you recognize that your ego is in fact a fictional character that you've created, and that you've created it out of the debris of the experiences of childhood and traumas and projections and all of the various uncertainties that have caused you to develop an attitude and ego defenses and a frame of reference and a belief system, et cetera, et cetera, all of that has to be recognized as not who you are and not even a real world, but a fantasy world projected onto the world. And you make every effort you can to try to make that fantasy come true, but there's always disappointment because the real one and your imaginary will never be the same. The imaginary will never be the same as the real, and the imaginary, without the benefit of symbolic self-critique that recognizes its imaginary and delusional, will never allow you to escape from its labyrinth. You will always be trying to find that place or those people who recognize you and who will give you the power and the authority and the perks and whatever it is that will make you feel like you've made it, and now you can rest on laurels that have been earned. But they can never be earned because you depend on the other to validate you. And it's that dependency that's the ego's problem. Because even if you make that hit record, then they're going to say, well, where's the next record? You know, that one was okay, but what's next? This is what you did for me yesterday. What are you going to do for me today and tomorrow and the next day? And so the ego is on a treadmill. So a realization has to hit home that it's in my interest to negate my ego rather than to try to affirm it. It's that shift of motivation that will determine your destiny. You affirm the ego, then you're in the ego, and the ego becomes your reality, and it's a reality peppered with traumas and with self-sabotage and with neediness and dependency and et cetera, et cetera. I don't need to belabor the point. So only the negation of the ego. No, there is no ego, just as there is no mountain or rivers for the Zen student who finally gets it, that this is a dream and it's all just information and even time is an illusion and space. This is a holographic image in the mind. I'm not really in it. I'm not in the body. The body is part of the dream field that I have imagined. And when I can see that behind it there is light and there is an intelligence that is able to awaken from the dream and modify the egoic structure, but also be free entirely of the predicate that binds your identity to the body and thus makes you feel mortal and have to suffer the aging, the death of the body, and all of the vicissitudes and suffering that the body is heir to. So the negation, that crucial second step of the dialectic is where the resistance stops the process. But if you're willing to go into that and say, no, there is no ego. I was never this character. I am just pure awareness. I was aware of this character, but I'm the same awareness now as I was then. And when the character's mental apparatus was formed, and then different layers were added to it, but that apparatus is obsolete. It belongs to an infant. It doesn't belong to an adult. But somehow I never went through the rite of passage to eliminate that no longer serviceable mental program that is not subtle enough and nuanced enough and profound enough to navigate through life successfully. The ego is not intelligent enough because it has a sensor that censors most of your intelligence and gives you the illusion you have freedom of will, but you don't, because the ego determines what you want. You can't want anything that your ego doesn't want you to want. So in the negation, there is freedom, but at the expense of not knowing who you are. So that's the problem with the second phase. I know who I'm not, but I don't yet know who I am. And the terror of depersonalization becomes the second obstacle, right? And only when you get to the third step, in which you can again say, I am, because you recognize, yes, I am. I am presence. I am awareness. But I'm not what I am aware of, and I am not the thinking apparatus of the body that I thought I was. I am awareness that has never been born. And that world that was born with the ego, I am no longer in, and I recognize it as a fantasy projection. And now I can be what I really am. The third step is what Ramana called the aham aham. I am I, but I'm not it. I'm not the body. I'm not that. I'm not this person. I'm not some entity within the field. I am that all-containing and all-saturating intelligence that is producing the field. And in that, I am, it includes what had been the ego. The ego is not dissolved entirely because the all-containing non-duality of the real self is the non-duality of duality and non-duality. So I can live as a bodily being, but no longer the ego. But the I am becomes an avatar in the body. And then divine life begins. And it's divine life that makes life worth living, not human ego life. It's that vibrational frequency that is only attained through going through the negation of the ego and the openness to the infinite spaciousness and the subtlety of the vibrational energies that underlie space and time, that bring the bliss, the Satchitananda, into full emergence from its primordially repressed dungeon. And then the journey is over when that dialectic is complete. But the divine celebration begins. Life becomes a true celebration of one's genius, of one's powers of mastery, of one's ability to understand everything, and all of the wisdom of the real self becomes accessible, and all of its latent powers that the ego cannot reach. So this transformation makes all the difference in the kind of life that you lead. But you have to have the courage and the strength and the understanding of the need to negate the ego as one's real self and to let it disappear so that you can be for real in the space of consciousness free of an I thought. Because only in that freedom are you able to realize what you are. As long as you are subject to the ego's thoughts and you still allow the ego to impersonate you so you think its thoughts are your thoughts, then you're trapped. You've put yourself in bondage. And the ego's paranoia and anxieties and all of that will hold you as its prisoner. But it's all an illusion, and there's nothing to fear. So why not be free? Anyway, that's what yoga is about, and it is this structure, this dynamic of the thesis and the antithesis, if you wish, the negation, and then the denouement of the revelation of the negation of the negation and the real I am-ness becoming fully recognized as yourself. This is the moment when the lightning bolt strikes. And because there is only the self, and the ego is an illusion, and even the soul at level two of the negation, because that's where that happens, the soul is that level of consciousness that knows it's not the ego, and then has adoration for its real self, because its heart is open in chakra four, and its wisdom is open in chakra five, and that adoration unifies the soul with the spirit, with the self, and that unity then dissolves any remaining karma. It can all happen in a moment if one is willing to recognize the negation of the ego as true. Because once you realize the ego is fictional, then all of its doubts, its problems, its symptoms of suffering, all of that have nothing to hold on to, no ground, no reality. They can't influence you anymore. They can't trap you. You can laugh at them. You are no longer subject to its belief system. So it's this triadic logical form that will get you to freedom instantaneously if you recognize the truth of all three immediately. And everyone has the intelligence to do that. And the only question is, am I willing to give up my attachment to that identity, knowing it's the source of my suffering, and it will not bring me happiness, even though it promises to do that? It can't. So once that is clear, then you realize there are no obstacles except what you create and hold on to. And none of the ego's attacks upon your goodness, your worthiness, your divinity, your intelligence, your worthiness to be divinized and completely liberated, none of its doubts and self-attacks will be able to reach you or have any influence. None of its thoughts and emotions can create disturbance any longer. And all those symptoms of the ego's inner conflicts will simply dissolve. And once you know who you are and you have access to your real will and your real intelligence and your real heart, life becomes beautiful. Infinitely beautiful, not just as a beautiful hope for the future, but beautiful now and in every moment. So that's the teaching. Now, it's nothing new, so I doubt that anyone is shocked by this. It's simply, again, a short summary of what everyone already knows. But I want to put it tonight into the context of what's going on in the apparently mad world that we're in. Because it's the same structure, and it's a very beautiful example of Shiva's sense of humor, and of the nuances and levels of intelligence that the ego, because of its projections and wishful thinking, cannot see or cannot see in time to stop itself from being harmed or affected or detoured or in some way deviated from its real goal and from its empowered understanding of how to move successfully through the unfolding drama of the world. Because once you're in your real self, you see the world from the level of the implicate order, no longer the explicate order. And the implicate order is present, all present now. It's not in a linear future, so that, well, I don't know what's going to happen next. The implicate order gives an understanding of a much larger event horizon, in which the clarity of the destiny of that unfoldment becomes much more transparent. And one can see around the arc of time. So the recent events are in the political realm in the world, particularly between Russia and NATO, are an example of the alchemical principle of as above, so below, or as in the internal consciousness, so in the external, and what is happening in the microcosm of the ego is happening in the macrocosm. And I've already talked about how this is a time of mutiny, and mutiny is the theme of the current part of the of God's theme park that we're all going through and enjoying the rides on, and we've just been treated to a wonderful little ride over the last 24-48 hours for those who were, you know, watching with bated breath, you know, this performance that was going on. It was the most brilliant military ruse, I think, that was ever put over by any military national organization. You know, Napoleon didn't manage this, Hitler didn't manage it, Stalin, Clausewitz, Even Sun Tzu would have bowed, I think, to Putin over this one. So let's go back to the original understanding of what was happening this week, all right? Because most of the commentators that I've checked online still don't get it. And they were all fooled. Even the ones who, you know, should have known better were all fooled by this. So let's go back and see how it must have unfolded, knowing that the Russians have incredible intelligence gathering capacities, not just human intelligence. They have much better than the West has on Russia, but also the cyber hacking and satellite spying and all kinds of managing to infiltrate and pick up the messages that are being secretly sent among the enemy without them knowing that you picked it up, right? That's the basic job of the intelligence division, right? So the Russians clearly knew months ago that the West was planning to use this air defender war game as a possibility of making it go live and them doing this all-out air invasion of Russia and hoping to wipe them out in a first strike by a surprise attack. And Russia clearly knew this already because they had the plan this months ahead and bring this whole exercise into being and prepare all the vassal states to be ready and to refurbish jet planes, etc. So a huge logistical process was underway, and they were able to detect all of it. So what they did was they created a new Richard III, okay, named Prigozhin. And first they make him this heroic warrior hero, but then you see gradually he gets more and more unhappy with the bosses in the military and the Ministry of Defense. And eventually he's coming out and calling them the worst names possible. You know, nobody does this and gets away with it in any army. But he gets away with it, well, because he's a hero and he's indispensable and we can't do without him, right? And all of that. So he gets away with the most insulting statements and accusations. We're not getting any ammo. You're not defending us. And then later there's even a crazy general who put mines behind us so we can't retreat. And then you even bombed our people, right? So it gets higher and higher levels of antagonism to the Russian government. And he builds up his credibility as somebody who might be turned, right, to change sides because he's so angry. And he's got so much power because he's leading this invincible Wagner force, you know, that is all conquering. So when he's in Bakhmut, right, fighting this battle, he's collecting a lot of prisoners of war, some that he's actually capturing from their positions and command posts that have been surrounded, others who are simply surrendering voluntarily and wanting to be out of it. So he's got a huge group of prisoners, some of whom are probably very high NATO officers. They're probably Brits or Germans, right? And so he calls the highest officer in and he says, I'm going to let you go back to NATO command. I'm going to sneak you out of here. But I want you to give this letter to the high mucky muck who's making the decisions. And the letter says, I'm willing to change sides. I can lead a coup against Russia. I can win it, I'm sure. If you'll give me the backing, then I'll do it. And they say, of course, well, prove it, do it. And he says, okay, but it'll take me time, and I can't do it until about the last day of your air exercise. Right? So now they are waiting to see, do we go, do we do this World War III attack that might actually lose and we all die? Or do we hope that our most cherished wet dream is that Russia will come apart and there will be a coup and somebody will take over who will surrender and will split Russia up into different blocks and we'll get all the wealth and we win, and then we defeat China after that, right? So here is the opportunity, right? I'm sure they're all salivating over this and saying, go for it. And so on that last day, but right at the end of their opportunity to go live, yes, the coup is on. The evidence comes in. And there's even fake news. Lukashenko has fled from Belarus. Putin has fled. They don't know where he is. Airplanes are being shot down and helicopters. It's all fake, but they believe it because Russia controls the space. And Wagner's troops come in and conquer all of Rostov, They occupy this Russian city, And now they're moving to Voronezh there, and their convoy is going up to Moscow. Oh, my God. And then you see Putin giving this. I've never seen Putin like this, a brilliant performance. He actually looks scared, like, we don't know what's going to happen, but treason is really bad, and we've got to stop this guy somehow. I mean, they could have bombed him in 2 seconds anywhere. They know where he is. They have precision missiles. They bombed the leaders of the Ukrainian army already. They can't bomb this guy. No, we can't touch him, And then you get former prime ministers and others from Russia saying, we don't know what's going to happen, but probably he's going to end up taking over the government, And all of these rumors are put out, and they tell people again, yes, yes, okay? So they let the exercise end, and, the planes then have to fly back to their bases, and they lost their opportunity to do this. And in the meantime, under the cover of this, he's moving all troops into total readiness so that if there is an attack, they will now be able to knock down all the planes and win possibly a World War III, even though Putin doesn't want to fight it, but they're ready. And in addition, they've moved under the cover of this anti-Prigozhin thing, more and more troops to the border of Ukraine, so that now they are ready to do the big blitzkrieg. And I would bet in the next couple of days, they enter Ukraine from Belarus, from Russia, from Donbass, from all over, and they end this thing. And the West has lost its opportunity, and they're in shock with egg on their face, and they got taken, right? So it's a brilliant performance, and it gives us a reprieve from the end of the world, okay? So we owe that to Putin, I think, although Shiva, I'm sure, was responsible for his, getting that idea. But it was brilliantly performed. They have these incredible crisis actors in Rostov running from, bombs and all of that, Sandy Hook was a shameful, loser compared to this. This was an incredible performance. And so this maskirovka, they call it, the charade, this masquerade and deception worked perfectly. And now, of course, Prigozhin talks to Lukashenko and all is well. He's exiled to Belarus. Belarus is Russia now, What kind of exile? I'll bet you that once they conquer Ukraine, they make him like the governor or, the viceroy of Ukraine and just show. They always trusted Prigozhin. That's why they picked him. And what I don't think they got was Prigozhin is not the head of Wagner. He has no power in Wagner. He's a figurehead. The guys who really run Wagner are special operations experts who are part of the Russian army. And they're not mutinying. There was never any possibility of that. And there was never any possibility of the outcome being in doubt if it was going to happen. But they created this and made it last over 24 hours so that the time had to run and they could achieve their mobilization. and now they're all in place, and they have defeated the West's intention. Brilliant. So anyway, I think it's definitely worth celebrating, because it shows the victory of those who can think ahead and think outside the box and be able to create this kind of illusion that it would be clear egos would want to fall into and want to believe and disrupt their plans. Brilliant. So in any case, you have the same structure here, you know. First, stable and strong. No, there is a coup. No, Russia is stable and strong. And stronger and smarter than you guys. So that's the Russian Zen dialectic. And I'm sure they're drinking a lot of vodka tonight celebrating this achievement. So regardless of what side you might be on in this, if you do take sides, which would be kind of ridiculous, one has to recognize good chess players, you know, and the Russians are good. So there's a sense of mastery that still has its last embers, even at the end of Kali Yuga. Now, will it give us a reprieve for long? No, not for very long. Maybe a month, maybe a little more, but I doubt more, because the clock is still ticking, just as it was on the dollar and on all of the other problems that the U.S. and the NATO states have, and they're sinking fast, but they've lost the opportunity that they had for one Hail Mary surprise attack, and now they are no longer in position to be able to even attempt such a thing. So the tables have turned, and a different position on the chessboard has been achieved. So I think this is a good example of how intelligence will beat brute force and narcissistic delusions every time. On that note, I'll open the floor and see if anyone has any comments or agreements or disagreements or any question about the real teaching. Don't forget the first part. That was the real teaching. Judy, do you have a mic?
Is this on?
I think it's on.
Okay. I just wanted to thank everyone, since I'm leaving Tuesday. I just wanted to thank the whole Sangha for all the support and everything, and just everything that, you know, for this whole month. And thank Shunya, and just how wonderful it is to be here, and how much I'm going to miss it when I leave.
We'll miss you, Judy, and send you lots of Shakti and blessings for your journey onward. And who knows, you might be back.
I might.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You could start a coup here next time. Anyone else who would like to? Elizabeth.
Yes, I also would like to say thank you to everyone, especially to you, Shunyamurti, and the whole Sangha for this 4 weeks. Feels kind of strange that I'm already leaving on Tuesday together with Judy. Well, thank you for everything. It's been an incredible, wonderful 4 weeks, and well, a lot of struggle also with the ego. So, but yeah, I might be back also. You never know. Thank you so much.
All right, but leave as the liberated, pure awareness without an ego, no baggage. Leave that here when you go. We'll take care of it. We'll compost it.
Yes, please do. Please do. Thank you. Namaste.
Thank you, Sunya, for this brilliant this brilliant analysis of this week. I loved it. This is maybe a little bit off topic, but I have a question about the final teaching you gave the last morning of the retreat. This is Turiyatita time, and you talked about how other religions, not just Buddhism, go through a Hinayana and a Mahayana and a Vajrayana phase. I didn't quite understand that reference to Hinayana, Mahayana, and Vajrayana with regard to Christianity as you described it, and I wonder if you can explain that
okay.
more.
Okay. In a way, it has to do with the same structure. And you know, it's the same structure as the movie we saw, The Triple Cross. Remember, right? Prigozhin double-crossed Russia, and then he double-crossed the West, right? Triple-crossed the West. But none of it was real, okay? In the same way, Turiyatita is kind of a triple cross, okay? Because first, it negates the ego from the soul level. And that's the Hinayana. The Hinayana want a nirvana of the soul. And because the soul is individual, and they think, I will be liberated. Well, what I is that will be liberated from the emptiness of the ego, the non-existence, right? So the first nirvana is a nirvana of Turiya, but not of Turiyatita. And then the Mahayana takes it further and recognizes the non-duality of Turiya and the three Avastas, right? So its nirvana is still in samsara, but samsara becomes now not a veil of tears, but Sukhavati, the land of bliss, right? So the world becomes different because it's a manifestation of God and of the joy of God consciousness. But it's still not in Turiyatita. And it's only when you get to the Vajrayana and beyond that you get to the point where the Turiya, even in its duality and non-duality, has to be transcended so that you are in neither and in both simultaneously. You are transcendent of samsara and you're done with it, because there is no more I thought whatsoever, not even the subtlest Turiya identity, because there's still a subtle identity of the negation of the avastas, of waking, dream, and deep sleep. But in this state, no, it's changeless, and there never was any avasta. It was an illusion. So it's the ajata state, the state in which there's complete, unborn, infinite, eternal consciousness, and it never gets lost or forgotten. There's never a fall into a world and into body consciousness, no. So that's the ultimate state that has to be realized, but you have to kind of go through the Hinayana and the Mahayana logic to finally get to that triple cross of the ultimate reality, in which the cross as a crucifixion is overcome, and now there is only the blissful self that never suffers any trauma or any loss of its divinity at any moment. Does that help?
Very much. Thank you. Okay. One other question. You talked about Paul's teachings and how liberation or salvation was put off until the second coming of Christ. Uh-huh. So how does that fit into what you just described?
Well, because now he made Christ into an object of worship, right? So now you are limited to being in samsara and hoping that grace will take you into nirvana or the Turiya state. But it makes you dependent upon a grace that you don't believe will come until the end, and so your consciousness stops it from happening. And you become more and more resigned to a world in which you have to suffer and make do with an imperfect reality, right? Until it becomes intolerably evil and dark. And then, you know, you really want to wake up from that, and you go back to the original teachings of Christ, which are not those of Paul, but they are expressed most clearly in the Nag Hammadi Gospel of Judas. Do you know that gospel? It's much earlier, and they found it, you know, back in the 1940s. And this is Judas, Yehuda, if you prefer, who is the most trusted disciple of Yeshua, the most trusted and loved. And just as Prigozhin is actually the closest to Putin, they go back a long way. When Putin was a cab driver and Prigozhin was selling borscht and hot dogs in St. Petersburg Square or whatever he was selling, but they got very close when they were out of power. And he trusts him more than anyone, so he picked him to be the traitor that everyone would hate, right? He's the Judas. So, but in the Gospel of Judas, originally, Jesus goes to Judas and says, I can't assign anyone else this responsibility, only you, because I know you you have such great faith and love that you won't mind or be hurt by the fact that you'll be hated throughout history as the worst traitor and murderer of God, right? There will be no worse betrayal that people will hurl on your... But because you have no ego, none of it will affect you. And that's why you are chosen, right? So that is the real gospel. And once that is recognized, then you realize that you too are immediately free of any of the betrayals you have either done, committed, or had imposed on you, because all of this is a dream and we're all actually manifestations of God. And so that original teaching is what will save us from that Pauline heresy of no, the only begotten son is someone else and you're a loser and a sinful, right? Mea culpa, fall, sinner of an unworthy original sin, right? So all of that is eliminated when you get the true teachings of Christianity. And that those have now emerged again from obscurity that the church tried to censor for 2,000 years. Okay?
Thank you.
Nobody else? How's it feel to be back, Hanuman? Yeah? It's good to have you back. We'll talk soon. There's a brave one.
Well, I wanted to thank you, first of all. This was an awesome analysis indeed, and good news, I take it, that there's more time to work on the purification and and go inside. And just the, well, it's kind of about that, because my whole day has been about this story and looking at the news and seeing what's going to happen next. And it's taken up a big portion of my consciousness.
But you can see it was theater, right? There was no reality to it. It couldn't have happened that way.
It was very strange. That's what I saw. And also Putin's speech, when looking at it, I remember thinking, he looks different. He doesn't usually look like this.
No.
He was, it was almost like something was edited. But yeah, I think the question is I think it has to do with that fact of then there is no ego. And seeing, because I think that the ego was partly enjoying it, what was happening, and also partly worrying about the situation.
Sure. The ego loves to worry.
So, yeah, I guess there was just a big enjoyment of the suffering going on. But at the same time, it felt like watching a movie that was playing somewhere else, luckily. So there's that sense of, yeah, distance that makes it easier. But
and your ego could get you away from the question of who am I?
Yes, that's what it's been doing.
That's its main intention always.
Mm. And so I felt very drawn into the screen, let's say, and you mentioned it in the Pontifex, the six Pontifex points as well. It just stuck with me of like how you're when you're looking at a website or a movie, you're drawn into it. And I can notice that when looking and reading, it's like that awareness is gone, and then it takes a moment to step back and to realize it again. But I guess there's a fear, or I don't know if it's a fear, but a worry that the power of presence is lost, and that when engaging in these temptations too often, that will detract from the power to stay present. And so I guess how to stay free from that, at the same time stay aware of things that one needs to stay aware of, and how much does that potency get lost, really?
It doesn't actually get lost. It's just that you buy into forgetting that you have that power. Okay? That's the thing, because you see, the ego that you're still identified with does not want to be negated. So it doesn't want to be reminded of the fact that the I thought is an illusion and that what you are is an awareness. You weren't born with that I thought. You were born just as presence. And you still are that below the thinking apparatus or behind it, deeper inside. And so by externalizing and worrying about what's going to happen in Russia or anywhere else, except what's happening in my heart and in my consciousness, and to whom is this mental apparatus chattering, you know? And once I realize that I am not it, then I am free to realize myself. And then everything can be seen in a much different frame of reference, a much more infinite game board upon which, right, this drama is unfolding. So you are the only effort that you have to make is to stay in that effortless presence and not fall into the illusion of the I thought that connects you with a body of a person who's worrying about everything and contracting and creating narratives and fearful reactions. All of that is part of the fictional subtext of the character that is going to be enacted constantly if you let the character play out without reining it in from a higher level of authority that says, I'm done with those attitudes and symptoms and deviations, and I'm keeping the mind silent now by my adoration of who I really am, and all of that can now disappear, right? And then you can be, no matter what is happening, you will stay in that state. Even if the character needs to look on the internet to see what's going on or whatever it does, that will no longer create Maya for you, no longer illusion, no longer worry, no longer an emotional reaction. So you're free to see it for what it really is, right? And you don't want to lose that.
Yeah, yeah, because it's much better when that presence is there and that stability. Yeah, thank you for saying that. It helps. And I noticed that in those moments when being drawn out, that it's much more difficult to connect to the adoration and to feel the love for God. And then it takes a moment to really sit down and be with myself for a bit and feel it, but it's almost like then the resistance is also stronger to feeling adoration for God, as to where that behavior is cut or not identified with. So,
Yeah, the ego cannot have adoration. It doesn't even believe in God because God is much too subtle. And God is yourself, but it doesn't want you to know that it knows that you are not it, and it's trying to keep you in a trance believing you are it. You are this ego thinking apparatus and never recognizing that it has nothing to do with you. But once you do recognize that, you don't want to fall back into the illusion ever again. That's when you have to use all of your willpower in the form of adoration of the real self so that that's what you love. There's no more love being invested in the ego. And it's not love anyway. It's desire, but it's and fear and worry and all of that. But that's the way love is expressed at the ego level. But once there's real adoration for God and divine love, it's so beautiful and blissful and luminous, you would never want to go back to the ghetto of the ego mind.
Yeah, it is a ghetto. I noticed that.
Yeah, in fact, a hell realm.
Mm.
Yeah. So I wouldn't go slumming anymore in the ego.
It's a good motivation to get out.
Okay.
Move to a more beautiful neighborhood.
That's
Thank
where you.
You
belong, Kuru.
Thanks, Shunya.
Thank you.
Thank you. As you started talking about the events over the last 24 hours, you were describing the understanding the implicate order as above, so below, and you were talking about the event horizon and this importance of seeing the event horizon. And I was wondering if you could explain a bit more what you mean about that. I ask also because I had a very uncanny dream last night of looking out at the event horizon and this very great importance of what was being seen.
Well, the event horizon I'm using as a kind of a metaphor for the fact that the ego's boundaries are its own projections, its own belief system. And so it cannot see anything outside of that. And all it will be able to perceive are what it preconceives must be there. Because it never really sees reality. It's always only seeing its own imagination of what you think the person meant by what they said or what they didn't say or why they didn't look at you or did look at you or whatever, right? You're always interpreting every event according to the ego's feeling of being slighted, insulted, not appreciated, blah, 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 right? And so that becomes the event horizon, and you cannot see the beauty, the divine loveliness and perfection of it all because you have this tunnel vision that creates a horizon in which the light cannot break through. It's a black hole, literally. That's what an event horizon is, right? So the ego is a black hole. But once you are able to perceive that, oh, it's all God, it's all perfect, it's all light, then you can see an event like this one as, well, it can't be what it looks like on face value. There's something, this is fishy, this is not real, it wouldn't happen like this. And then you can begin to see, okay, what's really going on, and you can see how the future is going to have to unfold, because clearly you're not fooled by your own projection based on your own negativity and feeling that things are going wrong and et cetera, et cetera. And now you're free to not only perceive it, but to even contribute to the way that the dream field emerges. You see, the way that the implicate order gets expressed in the explicate, that will also be part of the non-duality that is perceived once you're beyond this this black hole that's the ego bubble. Once it pops, then all heaven breaks loose. And hell is harrowed, and the power of recognition of the perfection of all that is unfolding becomes simply a part of your heart's wisdom.
Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, so this question just kind of came up. Like, in the waking dream, like, do symbols come from the soul? Because it's kind of like a recurring flavor of almost like a fracture of, like, light coming through, where it's, like, impossible to believe in, like, a separate character. So, like, does that come from the soul?
Yes. Yes, the soul is in the symbolic register, and it has access to its own archetypal nature that has been lost and defiled and made very vague and distorted by the ego. But the soul can perceive that true nature and be able to re-emplace it in one's consciousness by using a symbolic deconstruction of the ego and its false beliefs and its repetitive, attitudinal, self-re-traumatizing program. So the soul is indeed where the initial power comes to modify the ego, but only when the soul is fully awakened to its own relation to the Supreme Self that allows that adoration and love to re-empower the soul, who's otherwise would be having a dead battery. And the soul's battery has to be charged by Shakti, by the lightning bolt that literally, you know, brightens your mind. It electrifies the consciousness again. And it's that then that enables the soul to completely eliminate the egoic resistances. Bruce.
Yeah, thank you for the teaching and for the breakdown. So when you were describing this recent event, what came to mind was the Paradox Counter Paradox book that we read years ago about family therapy, family right. systems therapy.
Yes.
And there was a metaphor that they used that has stuck with me, which is the lion tamer. The guy's in the cage with a lion, and he's got a chair and a whip, and he's not going to overpower the lion. It's impossible. So he has to use his own intellect to trick the lion into thinking that he's more powerful than it, right? So or come up with a ruse of some
yeah.
sort.
Yes.
And, I mean, I was just jaw-dropped reading that book because it was so counterintuitive, right? And I remember coming to this conclusion of, wow, these people have to be out of the imaginary completely and yet be able to use it in such a way that they can, you know, have these paradoxical effects on the family that they're attempting to heal by sometimes seemingly doing the opposite. So...
good insight. By the way, I think we should probably read those books again because we have so many people who weren't here when we were studying that. So maybe we need to re-dip into that book and or another one that summarizes the Milan technique is really what it was. Right? So but keep going.
Yeah, not much more. Just to say that I guess what. Like, there's the feeling internally is like there's like a fear of expanding to that degree of symbolic intelligence and analysis.
Trace back the fear. Where does it come from? Fear of what?
I think it's a fear of first I am the ego or disappearing, or and then there is no ego, the fear of that negation.
Yes.
And I guess a fear of going into the uncertainty and not having a guarantee of what's going to happen on the other side. There's no knowing that. I mean, you're telling us, so hopefully there's a faith in that, but there's still a fear within the ego that it's not going to emerge, or I guess it's not going to emerge, but that the consciousness won't survive that transformation.
Yeah, that's what the ego will tell you. But if you'll be in the soul witnessing the ego telling you that, but saying, I don't actually believe you and I'm going to experiment, I'll be a scientist. And then at the soul level turn to God with adoration, you will feel the power that it gives you, and then the ego's illusions will no longer tempt you, and you will have certainty. Oh, God is here. It's real. Shunya wasn't making this up, you know, and there is eternal life. And I want that. I don't want to just be a mortal being who is going to end up being very frightened by what's going to happen and all of that. I want liberation now. And when that becomes stronger than the ego's pull out of fear and contraction, you'll be liberated instantly. So, yeah, that's the game, depending on which you choose to believe in. But if you have faith in your real self rather than the fictional one, it's a much better bet. So it's worth it to take the risk of love to find out that it's real and that love will save your soul.
Yeah, and not that it should be about this, but there's plenty of evidence for that.
Indeed, there is.
Right, and I'm continuously astonished by many things. I won't get into it, but anyway, I appreciate it.
And I recognize your inner work, and I appreciate how far you've gone and how many punches and slaps you had to put up with from me in order to get to that point. And are still tolerating very beautifully and humbly, and I appreciate that as well, because your learning curve is becoming very steep.
Keep them coming.
Okay, you heard it. I got permission. Okay. Last shot, if anyone else wants to add anything to the conversation. Ah, there's a brave man.
Thank you. It has been quite a ride the last couple of days, but I appreciate a lot the growth that happens in that kind of pressure cooker environment when we're talking about even preparations for an event like World War and things like that as well. And I see the growth that happens through that pressure, and then I see there's a release, right? And the ego wants to, despite having seen growth, take that reprieve as a moment for the ego and not continue with the one-pointedness and the sadhana. So how do you not let why is it necessary that level of pressure, and why can't you just generate it for yourself in order to be able to continue to grow?
Well, the ego has to recognize that in order to cope with what it must face, it's going to need more power and more wisdom and more sense of separation and dispassion from the body and from the emotional reactivity. And the moment it clicks that this is not just a luxury, this is a necessity, then even your chakra one security needs get turned toward what I need is God. Let me take refuge with God or with the self. And so it no longer resists that liberation during that moment. Right, that moment when there's no atheists in the foxhole and the bombs are going off, and then the bombs stop and then they're all atheists again, right? But for that moment, there's a Christmas truce, and the ego wants to actually be liberated from itself and to realize the soul and its true nature and be saved from suffering. So that's what you have to use. Because it's sobering and it wakes you up and it makes you realize it's now or never, and you want to take action then before that passes.
But there's also this feeling of, I think it's like the story of the boy who cried wolf. There's like this event coming and it never comes, and then no one has any trust for that, right, for that kind of forecast. And I think a lot about, like, even Jung during his lifetime was talking about these dreams of like nuclear warfare and things like that as well. Like, where does, is that just a collective image of the end that shows up through lots of different teachings?
Well, it's all known. I mean, this has all happened before. Time is not real. And so, you know, it was known 2,000 years ago when the Book of Revelations was written and other books by other sages and all the traditions. They knew this day would come, and we need to stay ready for it by remembering who we are. And that was the purpose of all the religious paths, so that when that day comes, you would recognize the signs. That's what they gave, all the signs. I mean, there's a huge, if you go into the Vedas, huge descriptions of Kali Yuga, and everything that's happening today is listed in those texts. It's all there. And so this was all known to the so-called ancient world, but was just early Kali Yuga. But it was all mapped out. It was in the Ramayana even, right? It was in all of those early books and given to us to keep as our heritage, that we would never forget, so that when the time came, we would say, "Oh my God, it's it! They're going live, you know, with this exercise of the end of the world, and we got to be ready, and realize that we are beings of light, and forget about this density of body consciousness." So it's in there, and every soul will have an alarm that awakens it from the ego. But it can press the snooze button and go back to sleep. That's the free will you have. But you will get the message. Everyone gets it.
It's interesting. I definitely feel much more on the side of seeing that it's very feasible. Like, this isn't something that I have any denial about. But I'm kind of perceiving this imminent threat, if you want to put it like that, as just a mechanism for growth. Like, it's a... Mm-hmm. Would you call that like the a teleological force that's actually pulling us forward?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
like
it is.
That actual event of nuclear warfare, I mean.
Well, the teleological event is really God consciousness that's offering you liberation before we get to that point. That's the key. Choose your destiny and not be a victim of fate, right? And that's the power that we do have, the only freedom we really have. So if we make use of it, it's enough. But, you know, you are being awakened to that, and it's just a matter of how seriously do you take that message. And when it becomes the only message that counts, then you're not going to, you know, divert your attention, and you'll be liberated instantly.
Thanks.
Okay. Well, thank you. I hope that this this teaching is useful to everyone, and that you recognize that the negation of the ego is not a loss of anything valuable, but actually an opening to infinite potentiality. And so don't let the ego's doubts and uncertainties stop you, because you have everything to gain by going beyond the ego. You will fulfill the ego's own dreams by going beyond the ego that the ego can't fulfill. And you will be able to be a real server and helper and healer of many others by transmitting that energy of joy when everyone else is falling apart in anxiety and terror, and you're able to stay calm and centered and bring that peace of mind and heart into the world. And as we go further, that will become a priceless power. And as you go higher and higher in your vibrational frequency, more and more of that light will flow through you and be channeled into the world. And that's the highest good karma you can do that will settle all your accounts and enable you to be free of having to come back and do this all over again. So take advantage of the opportunity to pay off all karmic debts through becoming a bodhisattva now. It's easy and it's fun. I recommend it to everyone. It's up to you if you'd rather suffer, but it's a very joyous path, and it's open to everyone who prefers to be happy than to be worried, right? So may you all choose Mahasukha. Namaste. Namaste.